Coming up on episode 264 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the Hyundai Santa Cruz, the Ferrari Purosangue, pricing for the 23 Honda CR-V, Tesla Autopilot class action lawsuit, no Hellcats for the Chrysler 300, VW ID. Aero, Lincoln Corsair, and more. All that coming up next. This is episode 264 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abual-Samad from Guidehouse Insights.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from, let's say, TechCrunch this week.
And Nicole is somewhere. I can't remember where. she's not somewhere. Here.
She's somewhere out there.
Yes, traveling.
I was going to sing the Fireball song from
Yeah, next couple of weeks are going to be pretty hectic for travel. I know one of the places Nicole's going is Vietnam. She's going to be in Bozeman next week, where I will also be. So we'll be recording something from there. But beyond that, I can't remember where she is right at this moment. So anyway, safe travels, Nicole.
She's on the planet. We can tell you that.
Yes. She might be slightly above the planet. We're not quite sure. She might be in the air still.
Oh, that's true. She's near.
She's within the atmosphere
of the planet.
She's within our biosphere somewhere.
Yeah, she's somewhere.
Yes. All right. Since you didn't drive anything since we last recorded just 3 days ago, I'll talk about the Hyundai Santa Cruz 2.5 turbo all-wheel drive limited or something like that. Limited all-wheel drive, actually, is the way it is on the Monroney. So this is Hyundai's version of the modern trucklet, as we have dubbed these compact trucks. This came out, almost exactly the same time as the Ford Maverick. It's very similar in size to a Maverick. The main differences, the Santa Cruz is a little more expensive. Base price. It's not as fuel efficient. And it's definitely more stylish. It's more upscale than the Maverick. The Maverick,
yeah.
For when you sit in the Maverick, you look at the Maverick, and especially when you get inside, you can see where Ford said, okay, we want this to be a very affordable vehicle. We're going to give you all the functionality that you need, but it's not going to be fancy. It's not intended to be fancy. It does what it does extremely well. The Santa Cruz, on the other hand, is derived from the Tucson crossover. I mean, it is essentially a Tucson with a bed on the back. The sheet metal on the sides is slightly different from the Tucson, but you can see the family connection there when you look at the front end, the front half of it. It is very much a Tucson with a bed, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's a really good vehicle. For some reason, Hyundai has opted not to include a hybrid powertrain in here at this time, the way they did with the Tucson. And from conversations I've had with Hyundai, they said, yeah, there was some issues with trying to package the battery for the hybrid. I'm guessing that, at some point during the life cycle of this vehicle, we will see it with at least a hybrid and possibly a plug-in hybrid powertrain.
Yeah.
So that means that the base Santa Cruz is not nearly as fuel efficient as the Maverick, the base Maverick, and it's also more expensive. It's 2.5 liter four cylinder naturally aspirated in the base model, and 2.5 turbo in the version that I had, the upscale model. So that I think is about 250 horsepower, if I recall correctly. As I said, it's roughly the same size as the Maverick. So it's got similar capabilities. It'll carry five passengers, four comfortably, but five in a pinch. You can put three across in the rear seat. And if you got three kids, not a problem putting them in there. They'll fit fine. As long as they're not all in car seats. It does what it's meant to do, which is provide basic transportation with the extra utility of a pickup bed. And it really, you know, I think it provides, unless you have to tow significant amounts, it provides all the pickup utility that the vast majority of people need. It's not going to haul 2,000 pounds. It's not going to, you know, tow 10, 12,000 pounds, but that's okay because most people don't actually need that.
Yeah.
It's the
tiny Honda Ridgeline. That's what.
Yes. And frankly, it's not that tiny either.
You know? That's true.
I mean, it's big enough. You know, it's not like if you're old enough to remember the Subaru Brat from the 1970s. This is the 70s, right?
I had a teacher that had a Subaru Brat, and I was so jealous of her. It's fourth grade, so it doesn't really count. Like me, like, oh no, but I really wanted that car.
Well, you know, I mean, the Subaru Brat was a lot smaller than this, and you know, the Baja that they did in the 2000s, based on the Outback, was also it certainly had a smaller bed than this did.
Yeah.
So, you know, during my week with the Santa Cruz, we're in the process of building a new rain garden in our front yard, so that there's less grass to mow. In the process of doing that, I went over to Lowe's, loaded up the back end of this Santa Cruz with 20 40-pound bags of topsoil, 800 pounds. Not a problem. You know, you could see, you know, the springs compressed a little bit, but it, you know, it's not like it was dragging its rear bumper down the ground, and it had no problem at all with that. There was plenty of room in there, and I probably could have put another 10 bags of topsoil in there, I figured that was going to be enough.
Does it have like a tow button, like a drive mode or a haul drive mode? Because the Maverick had it, and I went and I picked up like 800 pounds of like rocks twice. And the first time I didn't even bother. I didn't think about the button. I just drove home. I'm like, yeah, this is fine. And then on the second time, I'm like, oh yeah, the haul mode I pushed. And I'm like, oh, a little bit more torque. It's fine. It didn't matter.
Yeah. So I just pulled up the specs. The turbo is 281 horsepower, a little more than I thought, which is more than what you get with the 2-liter turbo option in the Maverick, which is 250, I think. And 311 foot pounds of torque. So this, you know, the 800 pounds of soil in the back end, not a problem at all.
Nothing.
It didn't even blink. You know, if you had the base engine, you know, it would probably feel a little more sluggish with 191 horsepower, and a lot less torque, only 181 foot pounds of torque. But with the turbo, it's fine. You know, when you get in it, if you sat in a current generation Tucson, you will feel immediately at home in this thing. It is, you know, it is the exact same interior, same seats, same dashboard with the center stack that kind of flows down from the top of the dashboard. The Limited that I had the larger 11 or 12 inch touchscreen display. The base models or the lower trim levels actually have a slightly smaller 10-inch display. And if you get those, you actually get some physical controls that surround it, like a physical volume roller and some physical climate control buttons, which I think if I was buying one, I might actually opt for that. Because one of the complaints I've had with both the Tucson and now with the Santa Cruz is when you get the larger screen, everything is a touch-sensitive control. It's basically a flat surface below the touchscreen, and you know, so you've got to look at it to you know, change the temperature or anything like that, and it is a little annoying. I might recommend actually going for one of the lower trim levels so that you don't have that issue. But other than that, you know, the rest of it, you know, the Limited, this one had the leather seats in it. It had nice soft touch surfaces. If you get the lower trim levels, you know, like on the top of the dashboard, it's going to be, it's going to look, the graining looks similar, but when you touch it, it feels, you can feel hard plastic instead of soft touch material. But you know, that's not that big a deal. The downside of the Limited is the price tag. So it gets a little pricey when you go all in, all-wheel drive and everything else. This
it
one
jumps so quickly.
It does. Because the Santa Cruz starts at about a little over $25,000. The one I had was priced out at $41,100, including guess the destination charge.
Ooh, hold on. $1,100.
Very close, $1,185. You probably would have won on Price is Right.
I'm getting really good at this.
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't look it up. I'm like, oh, I gotta fit. This is like my new. This is my favorite game in the world now.
I can see Robbie here on the Zoom screen. Yes, he's closing his eyes, thinking about it.
I stop and ponder.
Yeah. again, the other negative of the Santa Cruz versus the Maverick is fuel economy. Even compared to the base naturally aspirated engine, I think is rated about 26 miles per gallon combined. The turbo is rated at 22 miles per gallon combined. So 19 city, 27 highway. In my week of driving it, I averaged about 20. So a little bit less. And that was with a mix of highway and city driving. So I got a little less, a couple of miles per gallon less than what it's rated at. For a small truck, especially at $41,000, and only 20 miles per gallon. Now you got to think, do I want to go with the smaller one or, go up a size, to something like a Ridgeline, a Ranger or a Colorado Canyon. Mm-hmm. It starts to become a little bit tougher choice, which is why I think I suspect that Hyundai is probably going to find a way to do a hybrid version of this at some point during its model life cycle, maybe for 24 model year, so do a mid-cycle update and add the hybrid option, because with the hybrid Maverick, you get 40 miles per gallon easy. I mean, you don't even have to try. And
easy.
Yep. So that is the one downside, but with, as part of the limited trim level and everything, you get this nice hard tonneau cover. This tonneau folds up. So there's a handle on the top. You push it and you just shove the thing forward and it basically folds up like an accordion up at the front edge of the bed. And one of the cool things is it's got this strap that is clipped to the tonneau cover and then there's a clip on the side of the bed. So when you're loading stuff in there and then you want to pull the tonneau back to close it, you just grab the strap and just pull it back. So you don't have to try and reach all the way up to the front edge of the bed or walk around the side. You can just pull the strap, pull it back, latches in place and close the tailgate and you're good. And you have a nice secure storage area. So that's kind of a cool feature. Overall, it drives really well. It's, 280 horsepower. It's more than quick enough. Handling is quite good. So it's quite a pleasant vehicle to be in. Like I said, lots of utility. I think the total payload is about 1,400 pounds. Four adults and 800 pounds of topsoil, and you're good to go. That's the 2022 Hyundai Santa Cruz limited all-wheel drive. $41,000 out the door. Boom.
I really liked. I finally got to drive it back in August, and I really liked it. I think it's a Hyundai makes you feel like you're getting more for your money. Mm-hmm. Of course, once you hit the limited spec, you're just like, whew. But if you're looking for a small truck, there's really only two right now. There's this and the Maverick. If you want to be a little bit fancy, you want to have a little bit nicer experience, you go with the Hyundai. If you just want a down and dirty truck, you go Maverick.
Yeah. The Maverick is selling as fast as they can build them right now. The Santa Cruz is not selling quite as fast, but I think they're supply constrained as well, because the Santa Cruz is built in Korea. It's not assembled here in the US right now. As supplies improve, those sales should go up as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how how it shakes out in a few years, because now apparently Dodge wants to build a small truck, and everyone's now wanting to do a small truck. You need a Subaru. I think I probably said this before. They're probably kicking themselves. They're like, come on. Come on, we have the Baja and you guys didn't buy it. And now the Baja, like, you can't even find those things because everyone's like, oh, this is a good car. It's like the Element. The Baja and the Element are like these weird cars that when
they
they
were
came
before
out,
their
like,
time.
yeah, people bought them and they're like, oh, this is cool. Like, and then afterward, once they went away, they're like, oh, wait, these are really cool. Then every more and more people want it. It's like, oh my God. Oh, wow.
All right. Speaking of pricing, recently, Nicole had a chance to drive the new 2023 Honda CR-V. She quite liked it. Pricing has now been released on the CR-V, and it's gone up quite a bit from 2022 model year. If on the off chance that you can find a 22 CR-V, you might want to consider snapping it up, as long as there's not too much of a markup on it, because the 23 model year, the two-wheel drive EX, starts $32,335 with the including the destination charge, and goes up to just shy of $40,000 for the sport touring all-wheel drive. So that's for the hybrid. The hybrid is actually not much more expensive. It's only about $1,500 more than the gas version. So you probably want to take a look at that if you're looking for fuel economy. But yeah, these things are getting pricey.
It's a jump.
Yeah,
it's not a small jump. It's a big jump. It's like what, $6,000 something.
Yeah, I think it's about $5,000, but
$5,000. It's a lot of money. So yeah, if you're looking for CRV, and you know, that's, yes, it's a lot of money. That's also, you know, whenever you get into a Honda and you just close the door, it's like thump, and you're like, oh, that's what I'm buying a Honda for. But yeah, that's oh, quite a
yeah. No, actually,
that build quality.
You're right. It is almost $6,000. The 22 was 26.8 to start.
Oof. Yeah, that's a lot. Again, I mean, it'll probably last 700 years, so you're going to get your money's worth. But also, yeah, if you can get if you can somehow find a 2022, and you don't care about whatever the 2023, you know, differences are, which probably, I mean, I'm sure it's a great vehicle. CRVs just, you know, year over year just continues to get a little bit better, but the baseline for it is so great that you're just like, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
I mean, So, go find one now.
All right.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
At a slightly higher price point, there was another new, they don't want to call it an SUV or a crossover, but there was another vehicle revealed this week, the, Ferrari Purosangue. I'm not quite sure how it's supposed to be pronounced. This is, Ferrari's first regular production four-door model in their history. They, at various times, they have built a small number of four-door models, you know, as custom builds for various important customers, various important clients. But this is their first four-door model in their history, in their lineup. It's sort of SUV-ish. It's taller.
It's a hatchback.
It's a hatchback. This replaces the GTC 4 Lusso slash FF in their lineup. The FF and the GTC 4, you know, were hatchbacks. You know, they were more in the vein of the old mid early 60s bread van, 250 GTO bread van models. This kind of takes that FF concept, makes it a little taller, little sleeker looking. It's a very different take on doing the super high performance SUV from what Lamborghini did with the Urus.
Yeah, Lamborghini goes all in with Insanity. It's just, you know, sharp lines, and whereas Ferrari is really going in, it's really smooth, very, you know, traditional Lamborghini look, or I'm sorry, Ferrari look. And you know what? The only thing that matters is that giant badge on the side on the fenders.
the yellow shield with the black horse.
Yep. No, that's all that matters really to the people who are going to buy this. To be honest, I think they're you know, the people who kind of wanted an Urus, but they're like, oh, it's a little too ostentatious, but I still want, you know, an Italian, you know, supercar. I'm going to get the whatever Prosangu, whatever. I'm going to get the new Ferrari SUV. I have to watch a video where they introduce it, so I figure out how to say it.
Well, you know, the proportions of this thing are also very different from the Urus. The Urus shares its basic architecture with the Cayenne and the Audi Q8. It's a 4-liter twin turbo V8, whereas, you know, this is a V12. Perhaps the last naturally aspirated non-electrified Ferrari V12. It's based on the engine that was in the 812 and the TDF and the FF. It's a 6.5 liter V12, 715 horsepower. And the proportions of this, when you look at it in profile, especially, you know, it's got more of the, you know, you can see more of the DNA from something like the 812 in this. It's got a much longer hood than the Urus does, and the cab is pushed back. It looks like it's going to be a proper 4-seater. It's got rear hinged rear doors, suicide doors, as they used to like to call them. It's a very different beast from the Urus.
Yeah, that engine is so far back in the front of the car. Like you can actually look and see where if you go to the site and go down the engine, discover more, you can see how far back it is to sort of help with that weight split. It's completely behind the rear axle. Yeah, it's completely behind the rear axle. You have all this room up front, and you know, you see this, they put a lot of thought and a lot of work into this, and I actually like it. I know people are split on it. I like it. I think that they're going to sell more of these than they do of anything else. I think it's going to be the same thing that the Urus people are like, Urus are the same thing with the Macan and the Cayenne, but they're going to sell a lot of these. I think they're going to be fine.
It starts at $400,000.
Yeah.
It's a little pricier than a 296.
You know, if you have the family and you need, I need a family car, and I have, my price range. I don't want to quite spend, you know, $500,000. I want a little bit under that for taking the kids to soccer practice, or I'm assuming lacrosse. This seems like something like
we're it's probably lacrosse. More lacrosse, field hockey.
Yeah. Yeah. The rich people in the East Coast. You know, the sports where they only, you know, they're essentially just, you know, made for the Ivy League, the Ivy League sports. They're like, oh, you know, basketball? No, we're going to do lacrosse. I'm like, yeah. That's not suspect at all.
I mean, you know, this thing carries over an updated version of the four-wheel drive system that they've had on the FF and the GTC4 for a decade, which is kind of a unique setup, you know, because most four-wheel drive systems, you know, you have all the torque coming out the back of the engine. And then somewhere in the transmission, you've got, you know, some sort of torque split mechanism that sends some of the torque to the back, to the rear axle, and then another drive shaft coming forward to drive the front axle. But this one is something very different. It's their 4RM or 4RMS system, because it's also got four-wheel steering. And so, and this, you know, unlike most four-wheel drive vehicles, this thing has its transmission at the rear axle. It's got a rear transaxle, as opposed to putting the transmission right behind the engine. And in part because the engine is so far back, you know, so this is how they got a 49-51 front to rear weight split. Yeah. And then there's a separate mechanical power takeoff unit mounted on the front of the engine that drives the front axle, instead of having a drive shaft going back to the rear transaxle and then another one coming all the way back to the front. They just add this power takeoff unit on the front of the engine. So the engine is literally completely behind the rear or behind the front axle. So it truly is a front mid engine vehicle.
It's interesting. If you look at this thing, like the bell housing going back to that rear transmission is really so teeny tiny.
Yeah.
it's a Tinkerbell.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's not really anything in it. You know,
yeah, it's just sort of because
the clutches,
there doesn't need to be anything. Yeah. It's on the back.
Yeah, it's an 8-speed dual clutch transmission, which is all mounted at the rear axle. So it's an interesting beast. 0-60 0-62, because 0-100 kilometers an hour in 3.3 seconds, 200 kilometers an hour in 10.6, max speed of greater than 310 kilometers an hour, so you know, over 200 miles an hour. It's something.
Yeah, you know, I think what someone told me, if you can't afford two, don't buy one. This is definitely people who can afford two Ferraris. They're like, well, you know, I got the one for the family. This is the family Ferrari.
This is the one to take the kids to lacrosse and field hockey, and then you get the 296 GTB to commute to work.
Yeah, this is my commuter. and then they have a Honda Accord. That's always the weird, like if you drive through like a really rich neighborhood, like you see all these amazing cars, and then like a Honda Accord.
Well, you need something CR-V. You need something that you know is just going to run every single time you get into it.
Yeah, I was doing a video shoot with the NSX a few years ago, and this guy rode up on a bike that cost more than anything I own, and he's like, "Oh, how do you like it?" I'm like, I like it a lot. You know, you can get a supercar, and then you can take it to the Acura dealer and get it serviced." He's like, "Yeah, I have a Ferrari, and it's going to take 4 months or 3 or 4 months, I forget, to get the oil changed. And my friend has a Ferrari, and there's something wrong with it, and he has to send it back to Italy to get fixed, and it's going to be like 18 months, some crazy amount of time." And I was like, "Oh, okay." He's like, "Yeah, this like he's
that's,
like,
that's worse than trying to get service on a Tesla."
Yeah. What's going on with your Ferrari? I got to stick it on a boat, send it back to Ferrari, so they can fix something.
Well, I mean, like, if you're serious about it, you're going to get it packed up and put it in the belly of a 747.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. You're going to air freight it. You're not going to put it on a boat.
You're going to air freight it. But it was, it was very much a, this is how other people live sort of type of situation where I'm like, hey, this is it. He's like, this seems like a really cool car. Maybe I'll get one of these. You know, as you just go out and buy an NSX.
Yeah.
As your Honda Accord.
Well, you know, the first time the last time I drove an NSX, I think it right up through the end now, it still has the same audio system in it, which is actually the very same infotainment system that's in our Honda Civic. It's the touchscreen system. Doesn't have a volume knob. It's got touch controls for volume and everything.
That was the
display audio system that they launched on the N15 on the Fit and the Civic.
Yeah, they fixed that.
Yeah.
Put a knob because I think everyone's like, no. And they're like, okay.
Yeah, but the NSX still had that system in there.
Oh, that touch volume control is just a pain.
Yeah. All right.
Now we're ripping on the NSX for touch volume controls. We're like, oh, come
Yeah,
on.
no, I mean, the thing, if you're going to drive an NSX, just turn that off, roll down the windows, just listen to the
Yeah,
powertrain.
just listen. Just have a nice time.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of relatively high performance vehicles, Chrysler, on we didn't mention this during the last episode, but they the Tuesday night before the auto show, Detroit Auto Show Media Day, they had their own little press event. That was a fairly late addition to the schedule. And they announced the Chrysler 300C. So as with Dodge, which we talked about last month, they're going to be ending production of the Charger and Challenger by the end of 2023. And the Hellcat engines are going away. Chrysler is also making the transition to electric vehicles. They haven't, other than the Airflow, which is a sort of crossover-ish thing, they haven't given us any clues as to what else they're going to be offering, except they did tell me earlier this year that they plan to have about 4 to 6 models nameplates in their lineup. And presumably one of those will be a replacement for the 300 sedan. But for the final run of the 300, they've launched of the current 300, they've launched the 300C, which is only going to be available. I think the last ones are going to be built in February of 2023. And interestingly, they did not put the Hellcat in this thing. It's the only one of the LX vehicles, the Charger and Challenger, the other two, that never got a Hellcat. And apparently the reason why is there's just not enough Hellcats to go around to support the 300C, because they brought back the Durango Hellcat this year. They've still got the Ram TRX and the Charger and Challenger, and they can't build enough Hellcats to offer them in the 300C. So that's why the 300C has a 6.4-liter Hemi in it instead.
The fact that you can get a Durango Hellcat and not a 300C Hellcat just boggles my mind. It's just I don't know. I the Durango to me has always been like, eh. The 300 is always, I don't know. It's just something about the design and the look, and it's I think I really like the way the 300 looks, and it's not flashy. It's just like this very nice, like for what you were getting for the money. It just felt very classic. Like me, it felt like just like this very classy version of the Challenger and a Charger, and you're not getting a Hellcat in the 300, really? I guess it's fine, but the fact that we can't do it because we have a bunch of Durangos coming, which again, I've never cared about the Durango. The Durango's always been like, meh. It's like a forgettable. To me, it's always been like the forgettable vehicle in that lineup. Like, yeah, we're making a Hellcat. I'm like, really? All right. I'm
You
sure they
know,
sell a ton of them.
Dodge is the muscle car brand, and with the they're no longer they no longer build the Grand Cherokee Trackhawk since they introduced the new Grand Cherokee, so the Trackhawk is gone. So they probably figured, still got some demand for a Hellcat powered SUV, so let's build a few more Durangos instead.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
All right.
Oof.
Then
Sorry,
Tesla.
I was looking at the numbers of the Durango year by year.
Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah,
They've
65,000 last year.
yeah
And not
Com
oof.
compared to the Grand Cherokee, which shares its platform with, or at least the old Grand Cherokee and the Durango shared the same platform. The Jeep sold in far higher numbers, but all right. Tesla has been continuing to get lots of attention, not all of it positive, for its autopilot and full self-driving system. And this past week, a law firm in San Francisco filed a class action suit in the Northern District of California, demanding that Tesla stop selling enhanced autopilot and full self-driving, give back all the money to all the customers that paid for it over the last 6 years, and also pay punitive damages because basically, essentially, they're calling it a scam, which I have a hard time disagreeing with.
It's hard when you're charging $15,000 for a thing that doesn't work.
Yeah, and probably like never will.
It's going to do a thing, will it? Yeah. 15, yeah. I mean, class actions usually end up, you know, the law firm ends up with most of the money. The person who sends it does most of the money. Then everyone else gets like $50 in the mail after getting like that piece of paper with like, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's, you know, you're talking about just thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that people are paying Tesla for a feature that doesn't work like it's supposed to. And you're like, well, it's beta. I'm like, that's not what I shouldn't people. But, you know, people are paying for it. But I think, you know, when you, especially the first few years, when it felt like they were on the cusp there, you know, and at that time, everyone was on the cusp of self-driving cars, mm-hmm. you know, 2018, 2017, we're like, yep, they're only like a year away or two. Every automaker thought they were going to crack this nut. But now it's, you know, it's 2022. And the cost just keeps going up, which is, you know, counter to, you know, most pieces of technology where, you know, oh, you know, this costs this much. Now it's going to be a little bit cheaper every year to make this, you know, this technology work. But we're going to add more features to it is how, you know, why things keep getting more expensive. But the cost of the technology actually goes down. For Tesla, it's the thing that they were supposed to do, I don't know, 100 years ago. It's still the same thing. It's still supposed to do the same thing, but the cost has just skyrocketed. And then the fact that someone is suing them should not be, I'm surprised it took this long, to be honest. I'm sure someone else is probably in it. Probably nothing ever came of it because it was a bad lawsuit or bad filing. But they're losing a lot of fans.
Well, the argument that Elon Musk makes for continually increasing the price. And he actually said several years ago that they were going to start gradually increasing the price as they add more capability and get closer to, you know, to finishing it. Because the argument being that, you know, you'll be able to use your Tesla as a robotaxi, you know, so when you're not using the car, you can send it out on the Tesla network and have it give rides to people and start generating revenue from that. And so that would add value to the customers. And so that they should be paying more for this extra value that they're getting. Except that the reality is that with the technology they have, they're never going to get to the point where they can actually use this as a robotaxi. It's just not going to work.
As two people who are in robotaxis, yeah. Like last week, like the amount of work and sensor redundancy and sensor, you know, the amount of sensors that are in there, you know, and Cruise, I forget his name, the gentleman, the engineer over at Cruise, head of hardware, even he said, you know, it'd be nice if we can get to a point where we don't have to use as many sensors, like we don't have to use LiDAR. He's like, but we're not there yet. He's like, maybe we'll get there. Maybe that'll happen. Just be, you know, to reduce the prices of their vehicles. But the amount of work that they have to do, and then they have, you know, a back end that takes care of all this, and, you know, all of that. Tesla isn't really doing that. They're just trying to get it to do the one thing it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
There's no infrastructure behind it.
It was Carl Jenkins.
Yeah, Carl, yeah.
And you know, right now Cruise has over 3,000 employees. And, you know, a lot of those are working on the actual self-driving product, but a lot of them are also building out all the other pieces that are necessary to make this a business, you know, to create the network, you know, the backend platform, and the monitoring systems and everything else, the support mechanisms, for these vehicles, you know, things like, you know, they're designing, robots to clean the vehicles when it comes back into the depot. You know, they've got, robotic systems to charge it. And robotic systems to go in and vacuum and clean up the interior of the vehicle before it gets sent out on its next shift. So there's a lot of stuff that has to happen to actually make this a reality.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I mean, it's so difficult for all this stuff to work in tandem. And I remember when Tesla was like, "Hey, there's some." I don't know, it was in Europe, and it was when Tesla said, "Hey, we have a couple charging stations in Europe that will support non-Teslas." And I was like, "Great!" And I had the Tesla app on my phone, and I used to have a Tesla back when I was getting review cars from Tesla. I had a Tesla account, and I loaded the app, and I made sure it updated, and it just didn't work. And it hasn't worked for a while for me, and I just loaded it, and it seems like it's working now, so that's good. But the fact that, I mean, hey, we're gonna do a thing. Cool, let's load the app so you can try these non-Tesla chargers. Nope, never mind. Never mind. The app won't load. And it's like, that's not a thing you can have for something that's supposed to be a robo-taxi.
Yeah. No, it's got to just work. All right.
Don't
Another bit of EV news. Volkswagen is expected to replace the Arteon in 2024. So the Arteon is their current four-door hatchback, mid-size hatchback premium model. I quite liked the Arteon when I drove it late last year, I think. And you know, it's a very stylish vehicle. But the current generation Arteon is a front-wheel drive gas engine vehicle. I guess you can also get it all-wheel drive, but it's going away in 2024, and it's going to be replaced by the ID. Aero, which is an electric sedan, mid-size sedan. And they showed it in China earlier this year. What do you think of the ID. Aero?
You know what? I think it looks nice. You know, it's we. You know, with this, I okay. First of all, the fact, you know, the Arteon, cool looking, great. The Jetta, great entry level, nice, great sedan. Don't know why they ever made a Passat. I've been railing against the Passat for decades. I don't see the point of it. Like, I just want a really nice Jetta. Like, just get a nice Jetta. But no, this thing looks cool. I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see how well it sells in the United States, because it's a sedan, it's not a whatever, SUV, crossover, whatever you want to call them. But yeah, you know, if we can convince people, well, you know, the drag coefficient for SUVs has gotten really good too, so it's not like.
Yeah, but they are also, you know, even if with a low drag coefficient, they are taller, which means they
They
have
are
more frontal
taller.
area. So
That's true.
that
And
does hit
there's
them.
plus extra weight, and you gotta throw all that extra metal in there and battery. But no, I think, you know, I like to think that people, as we move towards EVs, people are gonna start looking at wagons and sedans again.
I'd love to see him back in 2019 at the LA show,
Vision?
the vision, the space vision.
Oh, the space vision was dope.
That
I
thing
love
was
this.
gorgeous. That,
And I
you know.
remember, did you have were you in the meeting with Scott where he was like, I think. So after they announced that there was a briefing with CEO Scott Keogh, who's now the CEO of Scout, the upcoming EV version of Scout, International Scout off-road things. He had this whole like sort of thought about the future where at some point kids would be like, they're not going to want SUVs because that's what their parents drive. And you don't want to be like your parent. You don't want to be lame and boring like your parent. So he was like, I really think we're going to go back to like wagons and sedans because SUVs are like what your parents drive. And it hasn't happened yet. And I don't know if it will happen. I don't know if there's as much, you know, rebellion against your parents anymore than there used to be. I mean, there probably is. I'm old. What do I know? But I would hope that part of that rebellion is we're getting wagons. I don't want your
I hope
SUV,
so.
Mom.
I hope Scott was right, but
I
you
hope so
know,
too. I think,
I'm hopeful but not optimistic.
I mean, and he talked about how it made way more sense to make an EV that's a wagon than an EV versus an SUV, and it was, you know, but it was a pretty fun, you know, it was a fun discussion where he's just like, yeah, at some point, the people are gonna want something different. He's just, you know, he's like, it's not like the SUV is gonna go away. It's just that the cool kids aren't gonna buy them anymore.
Yeah, I mean, there will always be SUVs, just like, you know, there will probably always be vans, minivans, and
There'll always be minivans.
they'll be a niche, you know, of the market. Although, you know, with the ID Buzz, you know, we could see the
I
instead of the
think the
wagon, it could be the reemergence of the minivan is the cool thing.
I think that, you know, I think the Carnival, I think, you know, the cool vans are cool again. Come on, kids. Get a van. You can take all your friends everywhere. Think how many friends you can get in the back of a van. Think of all the shenanigans you can get to. We had a friend who had a big, was it an Ecoline? It was a big, no. He had a big, he just had a van. Like just like a regular old van, not a minivan, a van. And we would just hang out in this van. There were no seats in the back. There was like carpet down. We would just hang out in the back of this van in my small town. And it was the greatest thing ever. And then we drive around, we'd just be rolling around in the back of the van like idiots because, you know, we're idiots and we're in high school. But no, that van was awesome. Everyone would all go somewhere in our cars and then get out of the cars and get into the van because it's like, you know, 20 degrees outside.
Yeah.
So, you know, vans.
All right. Until that time comes, we still have crossovers. So, and Lincoln is now, at least in North America, is exclusively a crossover brand. They have four crossovers, no more sedans left in the lineup. They still sell sedans in China. They've got a new Zephyr over there that is pretty cool looking. We've got crossovers here, starting with the Corsair as their entry-level model. And for model year 23, it goes on sale early in the new year. It's getting a mid-cycle refresh, it's getting a front end that looks more like the Zephyr that I just mentioned, which launched in China late last year or early this year. And the Zephyr is, you know, the replacement for the MKZ in China. And it has a new grille style, which bet you are completely surprised by the fact that it's actually larger than the old grille.
What? No.
Yeah. I know. It's a shock. Nobody does that.
Everyone settle down with the grills, okay?
The Corsair is getting a grill that looks much like the Zephyr. According to Lincoln, this is going to be the new face going forward of at least their internal combustion vehicles, as long as they're still around. So presumably this means that maybe next year we'll see a refresh of the Aviator that gets a similar style front end. I don't know if, you know, the Nautilus is going away, and it's going to be replaced by an EV.
It was such a weird, it was a great car, but it was so expensive for what it was.
The Nautilus?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. The other major change for the Corsair, there's not really any major changes for the Corsair. they dropped the 2.3 liter turbo that was previously the optional engine in there. So now they just have the base 2 liter, and they have the plug-in hybrid that they finally launched last year. And they decided, well, with the plug-in hybrid, we've got enough extra power from that, and we don't sell that many of the 2.3s. So we're going to drop the 2.3 and just have the two powertrains. And then they also made some changes in the interior. They got the new larger 13-inch touchscreen that they put in the Nautilus last year and in the Navigator this year. Because they've got a larger screen there now, the previous control panel that kind of cantilevered out from the center of the dash where they had the climate controls and volume knobs and everything, that has actually shrunk down. So it doesn't stick out as far as it used to. And unfortunately, they took advantage of that larger screen and moved the climate controls to a row along the bottom of the touchscreen. So climate controls are now virtual.
Gosh, come on, Lincoln. Yeah. I feel like these vehicles are perfect for my in-laws. They had an MKX, then they had an MKZ. They had a hybrid MKZ, and then they were like, oh, we need the MK. They went back to the MKX, and they're sad because it doesn't have a hybrid. But I feel like these vehicles are perfect for folks like that. And then they're like, hey, by the way, remove the climate controls into the touchscreen. They're like,
I know. Although you can use multiple voice recognition systems to adjust the temperature. You can use the built-in Ford system, or you can use Amazon Alexa.
They have thick Northern Ireland accents.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
this is not. Yeah. I'm just like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. They'll have to make do with the touch controls then, I guess.
Yeah. Oh well. Yeah. I just put climate, just leave some buttons in the car. Even Johnny Ive, we talked about it last week.
Yeah.
But like, you know what? Stop taking buttons out of the car. I know it saves money. I know it's easy to just like have software that's localized for all the regions you're selling your vehicle, as opposed to having buttons and may or may not have to be swapped out because they have words on them. But give us some buttons.
It works better. Buttons work.
Buttons work. There's a reason we had buttons for so long. There's tons of things you can put in the touch screen that make complete sense there. But give us our climate controller and our media control buttons.
Absolutely. All right. We have one listener question to answer. And that is from Dan Vesma on Twitter. Says, I shall shortly be, and this is a good one for you especially.
Oh, no.
I shall shortly be offering my 04 diesel manual front wheel drive X-Type Jaguar for sale.
Whoa. Wow.
Any advice on how to present and market an older car? It needs some work, which I'm loath to get done before sale, steering box and maybe a drive shaft and dog hair. So I think you've got all that covered except for the diesel, right?
Except for the diesel. I have the all-wheel drive, the 3-liter all-wheel drive, okay. V6 version. First, look on, if I were you, I would look on like KBB, like Kelley Blue Book, and just look at the value of the vehicle. Look at the, it's because, yes, you're going to want to clean it. You want to get rid of the dog hair. You're going to, you can get little vacuum cleaners for that. You can also use packing tape. Packing tape is actually wrap it around your hand and just pat it on the ground, and it pulls up dog hair like a dream. It's going to take a while. It's not going to be an easy job, but that's one of the easier ways we found to get rid of animal hair. We have dogs and cats, so there's like hair everywhere in our house. If you have one of the little vacuums that has the little spinning brushes on it, a small one, that will help a lot. And just give it a good, nice cleaning. As for like doing a lot of like mechanical work, see what the value is. If the value is pretty low, just kind of get it ready, because you're not going to, if you put $1,000 in to get $250 more, you're not going to, make sure that what you're putting in, you're going to get out of. And it will help to sort of sell it, but a clean car sells a lot better than a dirty car. That's, if I go out to see, I try to explain this to a friend once who got very angry with me when I told him, I'm like, well, if you're going to sell the car, make sure it looks like you don't have a kid, because I had his child in there. And he got super angry with me. He's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, people don't want a car full of Cheerios. They don't want a car full of ground up Cheerios. And make sure, people don't want a car that looks like a dog's lived in it for so many years. So do that, get some Febreze, drive around with the windows down for a while. Definitely look and see what the value is. I looked up the value of ours, and it was not a lot. It was like $1,500 at the time. It might be higher.
I just did a quick KBB valuation. A 2004 X-Type with a 4-cylinder engine, 100,000 miles, in good condition. The trade-in range is about 1,800 to 2,600. Private party is about between 2,800 and 4,400. So, depending on how much mileage you've got, it might be worth, at the very least, maybe getting it professionally detailed.
Yeah, that's like, you can probably get a
spend detail a couple hundred like bucks
200,
on that.
200, 250 bucks. Get it like really get it in there, get it cleaned. And I think that the used market is probably going to plateau or start dipping soon. So if you're going to sell it, maybe sell it soon. Then again, I might be wrong, but I'm just looking at some of the numbers I've seen out there on vehicles that are for sale. They seem to be sort of leveling out a little bit. But that could just be, it's fall and everyone's out, or summer and everyone's out having fun right now. And then, give it a good cleaning. Check on the value of what it's going to cost to, like, any sort of mechanical issues that you think need to be fixed. And if it's not worth it, then it's really not worth it. Just be upfront with the person who's going to buy it, because you don't want an angry person coming to your house. And it's a diesel, so it's going to be that's a bit of a unicorn. So you got that going
Yeah.
for you.
And I mean, this is based on the same platform that the Ford Contour slash Mondeo and the Mercury Mystique, I think,
Oh
were
God,
built
the
on.
Mystique.
Yeah,
Yeah, I forgot
or
all about that
Mystique, as a
guy.
lot of people refer to it as.
Exactly. That's why I forgot about it.
So those are pretty common. So the parts, depending on what needs to be done, steering box, half shaft, might not be crazy expensive, compared to what it would be for, other Jaguars. Might be worth, at least getting an estimate on the work. If it's, I probably, at $3,500 average private party sale value, I certainly wouldn't spend more than $1,000 on it.
Yeah, definitely would not do that.
If you know somebody, who, likes to do mechanical work and, we'll do it for, the cost of the parts and, a couple of cases of beer, and don't give them the beer until after the work is done. Then, you might be able to get that work done for under $1,000, and then, it'd probably have considerably more value at that point.
Yeah, just give it a shine, see what you can do mechanically. Again, we got ours for free. Ours was a gift because it was taken to the dealership to they were going to use it as a trade-in, and the dealer wouldn't give them more than $1,000 for it. And they're like, well, it's the value of the car is higher than $1,000. That's sort of the weird thing where you get to a point where the vehicle works, but the value of the vehicle is really low. But like the actual value to you as a person, you're like, well, this car's worth more than this,
Yeah,
and then
well,
it becomes
and there's always a big gap between, a trade-in value versus what you might be able to sell it to somebody, on Craigslist or, Facebook Marketplace or something.
yeah. This was pre-COVID, so they probably could have got 2,000 maybe for it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't it, yeah. It was you know that was it was a different time. So
Yeah.
they just gave it to us because it's like, well, we don't want to deal with it. And we've got and
You're a
because of
car
this,
guy, you know how to fix stuff.
yeah, that helps as well. But it also helped that because the value of it is so low, it costs like 20, 40, I don't know, I think it's like $40 for us to get like full coverage insurance on it. So if anyone like rams into us while we're doing something, they're like, right now we would get, probably $2,500, $3,000 for it. Like, all right, I guess buy another car. I don't know what we do actually, because she's yeah.
Well, I
Do
mean,
we need
you
another?
got the Kona, you got the BRZ. Do you actually need another one?
Well, we use we use the X type. My wife goes to work. She takes the Kona because it's her car. She needs to go to work. She actually has to go to work every like a regular person, and like me who just sits at home all day. When she's gone and I want to take the dogs out, I can't put them in the back of the. I mean, I can. I have.
Yeah,
They don't enjoy it.
but they're better off in the X type.
Yeah, they're better off in the exit. I've
So
stuck the
it's a
little.
dog transport machine.
It is a dog. It is really the dog car. And then sometimes we need to like haul some stuff in. And again, she's not around, so I just stick some stuff. I have to get it smogged this year. I thought I got it smogged last year, but time doesn't make any sense. So I'm like, oh man, I have to reset the computer because it has a check engine light, and the check engine light is essentially telling me the code is that we're throwing a check engine light because we can't check everything. It's not that we found anything wrong, it's that we can't figure out how to find anything wrong. And I was like, oh my
You need to
God.
get one of those OBD2 adapters off of Amazon for about $15, and get a free app, and just read all the codes and then clear them.
Yeah, it won't cl it'll clear everything but this one. As soon as you turn it back, it'll clear it, but it won't clear this one because the check engine light is that it can't check all the systems. So it'll clear for like a minute and then it comes back on because as soon as you turn the car on, it goes through the check everything and then it gets to a point and it gets stuck and it can't. So everyone's like, oh, just remove the unplug the battery, like your router, unplug the battery for a little while, plug it back in. So I haven't done I you know I haven't done that yet, so I have to figure that out. But yeah, it's I'm like, damn it, damn it. And then as soon as I got that and they came in the mail, I was like, I wish you just had another EV.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. All right. Well, that's all we've got for this time. I do have an interview that I recorded last week that has been on the Patreon feed for Patreon supporters with Jeff Hemphill, who is the North American CTO for the Scheffler Group. We had a really interesting conversation about some of the things that they're doing. And part of it is really interesting. We got into discussion of ride height adjustment systems and the impact that that can have on range for EVs. And Scheffler has developed this, there's a lot of vehicles out there now that have adjustable ride height, like the Rivians and so on, using air springs. But air spring systems are heavy and expensive. And Scheffler has come up with an electromechanical system that they can adjust the ride height. And it's way less costly to put on, doesn't weigh that much, doesn't really use any power. They can give you the equivalent, like for an SUV, the equivalent additional range of having extra 7 kilowatt hours of battery. We had a real interesting conversation. So check that out. And we'll be back next time. Bye.
Bye.
I'm here with Jeff Hemphill, who is the North American CTO for Scheffler Group. And Scheffler is probably not a name that most people outside of the auto industry would recognize. You guys are what make what's traditionally considered the greasy bits, the stuff that's underneath that make vehicles work. And this morning during the first part of the symposium, heard about some really interesting technologies. I know Scheffler has been doing a lot of stuff for a long time around e-mobility. And I think one of the areas that a lot of people don't necessarily think about with electrification is efficiency, energy efficiency, because you think, oh, there's no emissions, you're not using any gas. Yeah, it's good. It's all good. But it's a little more complex than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. An electric vehicle is very efficient compared to a combustion engine vehicle, but there is so much less energy on board the electric vehicle that you have to really be careful what you do almost literally with every electron that comes out of the battery. It has to do something useful. So, it's very important.
So your Scheffler is tackling that from a number of different perspectives. One is from in terms of motor design. Let's start off there, and then we'll get into some of the other areas that people probably wouldn't think of as impacting efficiency that much. So showed a couple of interesting things this morning. One particularly the direct slot cooling. Talk about that some more.
Yeah, that's kind of remarkable, really. After 200 years of electric motors being on the market in production, to be able to still be coming up with innovations like that. But the cooling of an electric motor is very critical. It actually pretty much determines the size of the motor. And most electric motors are cooled from the outside. So the copper that's heating up in there, it has to kind of bleed that heat into the stator, and then you pick it up on the outside of the stator. What we've managed to do is create gaps around the copper windings in the stator, so we can actually inject oil right down the length of the whole copper wire and pull the heat directly out of the motor. So that opens up a couple possibilities. Well, the first thing is it makes the power it almost doubles the power density of the motor. So most electric motors in an electric car, you probably have heard that they have a peak power and a continuous power. And the continuous or the peak powers you can do for, say, 30 seconds usually, and you can only do that until the motor heats up to the point where you might damage the magnets. But with this concept is so effective at cooling that for that motor, the peak power and the continuous power are actually the same. So that's how you get almost a doubling of the power density of the motor. But then it also allows you to do things in combination with our thermal management system. You can actually use the motor as a heater. So if you need heat to, for example, to warm up the battery, you can actually operate the electric motor inefficiently on purpose and pull that waste heat out with the oil. And then you bring that into our thermal management unit and you can distribute it then to the batteries or the passenger compartment. And so you can even eliminate an electric heater from the system.
So in that case, would the benefit of being able to use that heat from the motor to control the temperature of the battery offset the maybe a little bit of inefficiency from using the motor a little bit harder than you would?
Yeah, because batteries, somebody, I was at a conference recently, they said batteries are like humans. They don't like to work too hard. They don't like it too hot. They don't like it too cold. They're pretty particular. So if the battery's cold, the efficiency of it is miserable. Uh-huh. So the sooner you can warm it up, you win back a lot of efficiency.
It also helps a lot if you want to do faster charging as well, being able to precondition the battery to get it to that optimal temperature when you're on your way to a charger.
Yeah, exactly.
So going back to the direct slot cooling, I think you know one of the things you generally try to do when you're designing a motor is get as high a fill ratio of the copper in the stator as possible. Does having the gaps in between the windings, how does that impact it? How does that impact the performance? You know, because you obviously you're gonna have a little bit lower fill ratio in that case.
Actually, it's very close to the same fill ratio because it turns out in a electric motor normally the copper windings, of course, they have like a varnish insulation on them, but there's usually a paper or something around them as well. And basically, we've just substituted for that a kind of like a helix, if you will. So we still keep them separated like they would have been.
So they're physically separated by that gap that you allow the oil to flow through.
Right. So it's actually very small gaps between the wires. But because there are so many wires in the stator, you can pass a great deal of oil through it.
Oh, okay.
So it's quite close to the same fill factor.
Okay. So the motors... I think you know, maybe most people are not necessarily that familiar with motors, but the motors we find in most EVs and hybrids today are what we call radial flux motors. But there's another kind of motor that you've also got here today that's been getting some more attention lately. axial flux motors. What's the advantage of an axial flux motor versus a radial flux?
Axial flux offers a dramatically higher power density, so you can it is roughly double of a good radial flux motor, and it's just due to the way that you can organize the magnetic fields, if you will. So they have a great power density advantage, but they do come with some downsides because they tend to have fewer magnetic poles than a radial flux motor. They have a little bit more torque ripple.
Okay.
So therefore we've had to develop software strategies that you'll hear about in a later speech to correct that torque ripple and make it more acceptable.
So with the direct slot cooling, you can get double the power density. Is that doubling with the axial flux motor compared to a conventional radial flux or compared to it? So with the direct slot cooling, would you have comparable power density to an axial flux?
I've not done that math, but I guess in principle that would make sense.
Okay. I think one of the interesting things that we've been seeing, you know, one of the manufacturers that's been talking a lot about axial flux motors is Mercedes-Benz with their high-performance AMG group. They're planning to use that kind of technology in there. For both of these, for the direct slot cooling and the axial flux motors, where is Schaeffler in terms of production readiness? When are you going to see that either of those in production?
The slot cooling, I don't think we have a launch date yet. We're working on industrializing it, basically figuring out how to produce that. But within the next couple of years would be possible. The axial flux, I think we expect to have one in production in 26.
Okay.
So coming down the pipeline here.
All right. Kind of moving down the chain a little bit, you talked about the need to manage the temperature of the batteries, among other things, and thermal management in an EV is really important. And, of course, Schaeffler, one of the areas that you've got experience in with internal combustion engines is thermal management.
Mm-hmm.
And are you able to translate that expertise, are there new things that you're doing, new directions that you're going with thermal management for electric vehicles versus internal combustion?
Yeah, definitely. Building on what we learned from internal combustion, and as you said, when you get into electric vehicles, it's a more complicated problem because everything wants to be a different temperature, the battery, the passenger compartment, the power electronics, the motor. So you have a lot more branches in your system. So the basics of our thermal management module is basically a rotary valve that allows you to connect up to 8 different passages to each other. And so that in itself helps right away just to be able to communicate with all those different temperature regimes, if you will. But then we can build on to that. So for example, we're developing in-house a CO2 compressor. So if you use CO2 as the refrigerant and a heat pump for passenger compartment heating, we found a lot of gains that can be made in overall efficiency there. So we're even adding on components to our basic thermal management.
Okay. Let's move into a kind of a different area that also has a surprising impact on energy efficiency. And again, going back, efficiency is important for an EV because the battery has a limited amount of capacity. It's nowhere near the energy density of a gallon of liquid fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to utilize that capacity as best you can. You don't want to waste any of it. And so, and because batteries are also the biggest and heaviest component in an EV, if you can make that more efficient, you can reduce the cost of the vehicle, make it more affordable to more people.
Mm-hmm.
Chassis technology is an area that Schaeffler has had a lot of experience in. And again, I think that's an area that most people wouldn't necessarily think of as being important to an EV, but it turns out it really is.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was talked about this morning was the ride height control system, the mechatronic ride height control system. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's basically a application of our industrial ball screw technology to automotive. Basically make a concentric ball screw with an electric motor to actuate it and put that under the spring seat, probably in the front and the rear, although you can get some benefit just from the front. And for the EV, that really helps a lot because when you lower the vehicle, at highway speed, for example, you limit the amount of air that goes under it. You limit the amount of tire that's exposed, and you basically reduce the frontal area of the vehicle. So you can get, I don't know, on the order of 4 or 5% of range extension at a steady speed through that. And then, of course, you get some other ancillary benefits, like you can lower the vehicle to get in and out of it if it's an SUV, or you can raise the vehicle for off-road use if it's an off-road type capability vehicle. So you get some side benefits. But the big thing is if you lower the vehicle, you can either get more range or you can take out battery cells, and you can save a lot of money by not purchasing battery cells.
Yeah, I think the example that was presented this morning, they talked about with lowering the vehicle, the example vehicle that they used, dropping it by the drag coefficient by about, or the total drag by about 40 counts, which equated to the equivalent of adding 7 kilowatt hours of energy to the battery. And the best battery prices we're seeing right now are somewhere around $100 a kilowatt hour.
Yeah.
And these days it's actually probably closer to double that. So that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Is this type of ride height control system available today, or when do you expect that to be in production?
It is fully developed and tested. Actually, we started that quite a long time ago and didn't find the market terribly interested in it. But now with the growth of EVs, it's coming back. So it's been ready for production for quite a while. I think it's maybe 3 years away from when it'll actually enter production.
How does the weight and the cost of this type of system that Schaeffler's developed compare to the air spring systems that we see on quite a few, especially higher end EVs today?
Weight, to be honest, I'm not sure. I know it is significantly cheaper than an air suspension system, but I don't know an exact number there.
Okay.
But definitely cheaper.
All right. Another interesting area from the chassis perspective is some of the things that were talked about around steering. One of the things that is both good and bad about EVs is, because the battery has got to fit in between the axles there, most EVs tend to have longer wheelbases, which is good from a passenger volume perspective. Mm-hmm. You don't have the engine in there. It can spread those wheels out to the corners and open up that space inside a vehicle that's the same overall size. Flip side of that is longer turning radiuses,
mm-hmm.
Less maneuverability. And how's Schaeffler attacking that problem?
Yeah, that's where we again turn to our industrial group, who has a product called a planetary roller gear. So it's a little bit similar to a ball screw, but instead of balls, we have actual planets rotating around the threaded rod. And that turns out to offer a really good efficiency advantage. So we repackaged that into a rear steer actuator so that it can do up to, I think, 58 millimeters of travel. So you can actually turn the rear wheels, depending if you're parking or driving at speed, maybe with the front wheels or maybe against the front wheels. But you can do several meters of reduction of the turning circle for these longer wheelbase vehicles with that. So that's really gaining traction there.
Yeah, I think that's from a usability perspective, that one's probably not going to have so much impact on efficiency, mm-hmm. but from the usability perspective it does. But there's also some efficiency advantages that you can gain from the front wheel steer-by-wire technology that you're also developing.
Yeah, and there on the front wheels, we do actually use a ball screw because of the much longer travel and the fact that it has to be, it can't be self-locking. It has to return to center if there would be some kind of a power failure. It's a very, very efficient system.
Is what's the time frame for that to see production application?
I believe that's also for front steer. I think that is also 26 for us.
Okay. And what, besides the flexibility you get out of that, what are some of the other advantages of going to a steer by wire system, especially a front steer by wire system on any vehicle, not just an EV?
Yeah, it can offer a lot of advantages actually. As computers get smarter and smarter, eventually they're going to be able to make evasive maneuvers for the driver. But it could be very alarming to the driver if suddenly the steering wheel is moving around on them unexpectedly. So it would allow you to do things like that. You can actually adjust the steering without letting the driver know. And then, of course, as we get into autonomous vehicles, it enables a car without a steering wheel. But in between there, we're exploring some concepts like joystick steering. So maybe you have an autonomous vehicle, but you want to have a manual mode. You can have a joystick to do that. Or even you can steer with, a steering wheel or a yoke, but not actually by rotating it, but by applying torque to it. Mm-hmm. So And that's, we've built some demonstrator vehicles. It's really quite interesting to drive those cars. So it really allows you to reimagine the driver interface to steering the car.
Yeah, I recently had an opportunity to briefly drive a prototype delivery van with a steer-by-wire system from REE, an Israeli startup, and it was a fascinating experience.
Yeah.
Cause you have that disconnect between what the wheel's doing and what the vehicle's doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I liked what you mentioned about, you know, when you're driving down the road, you know, I mean, even if it's just something like, you know, crown of the road or crosswinds, a steer-by-wire system could be keeping the vehicle on the right track. It doesn't necessarily need to provide feedback through the wheel to the driver of what it's doing, but, you know, because as you said, that could create some distraction for the driver. So interesting. Another area of e-mobility is fuel cell technology. And what parts of fuel cell systems is Schaeffler doing, and where do you see that fitting in the marketplace? Because obviously a lot of the emphasis is around battery electric. But I think there is a place for fuel cells. But where do you see fuel cells in the marketplace?
Well, we certainly see on the mobility side, they would probably start off in the heavy-duty sector just because of the energy density and the fill time you can get with hydrogen is much better than with batteries. A battery pack to drive an over-the-road truck can be many tons, and you need a megawatt power charger to charge it in a reasonable amount of time. So certainly would see an entry there, potentially also for light vehicles. It's really going to depend on how the hydrogen market develops, I think. There's a strong need to use some kind of energy storage to stabilize the grid, because when you go to wind and solar, that becomes a significant part of your grid. It's not very steady, so you need some way to produce excess electricity when the wind's blowing hard and have that available when the wind is not blowing. And the favorite right now, especially in Europe, to do that is hydrogen. So you can run an electrolyzer off of a green grid and produce hydrogen, and then use that either in a fuel cell to produce electricity, or conceivably even to fire a turbine to produce electricity in a plant. And you can do things with it like we're exploring converting our heat treat furnaces over to hydrogen. So as the grid gets greener, and hopefully the electricity gets cheaper, or continues to get cheaper as it has been, then could be that we get enough hydrogen production that eventually it spreads beyond commercial vehicles and actually goes into light vehicles. Because again, you'll get that advantage of range and fast fill time compared to spending 20 minutes at a battery charger. You can fill up in five.
And what aspects of the fuel cell system is Schaeffler involved in developing or producing?
Initially, what got us involved is the bipolar plates. So a fuel cell or an electrolyzer, actually, is a stack of hundreds or even thousands of thin sheet metal plates. And we are, our oldest products are in sheet metal stamping. So we're big experts in sheet metal stamping. So we knew we could form plates well. And we also understand fluid dynamics from our torque converter work in the past. So we can design the passages in the plate where the hydrogen passes through there. So that's our entry point. We actually have a joint venture now called Symbio in France, and we're producing bipolar plates for them, and then they're putting it into a fuel cell stack. So that's where we'll start off, and then also plates for electrolyzers that create the hydrogen.
Electrolyzers basically the same thing as a fuel cell, in the opposite direction.
Exactly, yeah. But they do tend to be bigger. If you have a chance, you can see our display in there. A bipolar plate for a fuel cell for a car is, you know, a foot by a half a foot or something. But the the ones for an electrolyzer are almost as big as a door. So mm-hmm. it's a really big piece of sheet metal there.
And doing that with the level of precision you need for that type of device is pretty complex.
Yeah, it actually was a bigger stamping challenge than our stamping tool designers anticipated, because it's by far the thinnest sheet metal we've ever stamped. So you would like to get these under a tenth of a millimeter of thickness. So it's really a foil, and you have to put a very precise form in that foil without tearing it, so that you get the passage of the hydrogen through there in an efficient way, and also that you get the contact with the exchange membranes. You don't want to have lazy radii. You want to have sharp corners. So to do that literally with a foil is very challenging. But
yeah,
we have mastered it, so we've got some good stuff coming out there.
Okay. And then one last area, one of the last presentations this morning was around some of your engine technology.
Mm-hmm.
You've been producing a lot of components for engines for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and taking some of those now and using them in new ways. Talk a little bit about the smart overrun system.
Yeah, that is specifically, it's actually a combination of existing products for us, an electric cam phaser, a valve deactivation system, and an accessory drive system. But you put those together in a new combination to meet the unique needs of hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you hybridize an engine, you're going to want to turn it off as often as you can. And that creates a host of issues. For example, the catalyst doesn't like to get cold. So whenever you turn the engine off, the catalyst is going to start to cool off. And then it really doesn't like to have oxygen in it. So when you restart the engine, you're often going to get a blast of oxygen go through the catalyst. So you don't want any of those things to happen. And so with that system, we can, for example, deactivate the exhaust valves and protect the catalyst. And then we can gain some efficiency benefits. For example, controlling the valve timing allows you to reduce the drag torque of the engine. So when the engine is not running, and if you don't have a disconnect clutch for the engine, that is all just kinetic energy that you can put in the battery that otherwise would have just been going into friction drag in the engine. So we get something around a 5% improvement over the base hybrid system in fuel economy just by simple little tricks like that. But
now, is that just with mild hybrids, like 48-volt mild hybrids, or is that also with strong hybrid systems, high-voltage hybrid systems?
Also works with a stronger hybrid system. Depending on the size of the system, if you get into like a P2 system with a disconnect clutch, then you're actually bringing the engine to rest, so you have a little bit less to worry about there in terms of protecting the catalyst and so on. But it still offers utility for really any kind of hybrid.
Okay. Well, Jeff, I really appreciate your time. Are there any last thoughts that you want to share that we haven't covered that you know, think people should be thinking about?
It's just a tremendously exciting time to be an engineer, I guess.
Yeah.
I've been saying that for 35 years, but it's more true now than it has ever been. When I think about starting my career in manual clutch development, and now we're talking about solid-state battery cells and electric motors and power electronics, and so it's just going to be a tremendous good time to see these new vehicles coming out with all this new technology. It should be a great time to be a consumer of cars as well as a designer of powertrains.
I agree. I've been in the auto industry for over 30 years myself as an engineer, a writer, and an analyst, and
mm-hmm.
It is definitely the most interesting time of my career. So
yeah, all right, going to be great.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank you.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise. having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5HETide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5HETide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.